Welcome back to Vocal Point. This is Jerry Newcomb. 2014 marks the 100th anniversary of World War I, a seminal event in the history of the world. America's joining the war helped make the Allied victory a sure thing. And there's a new book dealing with this. It's called The Yanks Are Coming, A Military History of the United States in World War I by Harry Crocker, who is a best-selling author, and this is a Regnery history book. Harry, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Sure. Okay, so tell us why you wrote the book, other than the fact that this is the 100th anniversary of World War I.
It is the 100th anniversary of World War I, and I've written a fair bit on military history, including the Civil War. But I think a lot of Americans, you know, they know the Civil War, that interests them. They know World War II, that interests them. But World War I, which comes in the middle, is sort of this black hole in a lot of people's imagination, I think. And insofar as they think about it at all, I think they just think of it as a war of, you know, extreme carnage and futility, sort of a pointless, meaningless war of men jumping out of trenches and stopping chests with machine gun bullets. And, you know, of course, there's a certain amount of truth to that, but that really doesn't give the war, and certainly our experience in it, justice. And one of the things I tried to do in the book covers World War I, its causes, how it was conducted until we got in, and then all the battles we fought in. But two-thirds of the book is handed over to biographies of American heroes of the war.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone from John J. Pershing, who was the commander of the American Expeditionary Forces, to a lot of now famous names, which many Americans think don't know were in World War I, like Douglas MacArthur, George S. Patton. Eddie Rickenbacker was our air ace of the war.
Mm.
The famous heroes of the war was Sergeant York, a former pacifist who became a war hero. Or George Marshall of the Marshall Plan. Harry Truman, future president, was an artillery officer in the war. And when, by doing writing the book that way, covering World War I in that way, something interesting happened, which I didn't think about when I started off on this, but became apparent to me once the book was done, was that you sort of see the arc of the American century. A guy like a general, like General John J. Pershing, had fought Indians. He lived to see World War II. A man like Douglas MacArthur, whose father was a general, traveled across the Old West. You had memories of it as being like a John Ford cavalry movie, one of those old John Wayne cavalry movies,
mm-hmm.
and yet lived to see and actually fight a war in the atomic age.
Mm-hmm.
So you see these guys, these men, and the transformation of America. And in our own military experience in Europe in World War I, yes, we enter this, you know, there's this horrible scar down Europe, which is the Western Front and all the trenches. But when America gets into the war, it is both decisive. General von Hindenburg, who was the top German general, credited Germany's defeat to the American infantry in the Meuse-Argonne campaign, which is the final campaign of the war. But the other thing that we should always remember is that the American experience was not of blindly running out of trenches and into machine gun fire. The American experience was much more of individual combat, because when we enter into some of these battle zones, we're entering into these zones of, yes, barbed wire and trenches and blown up trees and forests, but it's sort of individual units, or individual men even, against individual German machine gun pits.
Hmm.
And more than one American soldier, including Douglas MacArthur himself, compared the tactics that the American Army used to the same tactics they used in fighting Indians. So I think it's a very gripping, interesting, largely not untold, but unknown story these days to many American readers.
Well, since much of the fighting actually occurred in France, I remember one time in a European history class, they said that something like one out of two French households lost a son. You know, it was just that many people that died. What were the causes of the war? And if I may, let me go ahead and just quote you directly. This is from page 7 under the reasons why. I'll just read this first paragraph and then you can wax eloquent on it. Those who class every modern evil as a consequence of the First World War seem to forget that Marx, Nietzsche, Dover Beach with its receding sea of faith, social Darwinism, nationalism, racism in Eastern Europe, Slav versus Teuton, militarism, Slavic terrorism, the Franco-Prussian War, the Balkan Wars, a crumbling Ottoman Empire, Russian designs on Constantinople, and the German Schlieffen Plan that envisioned the violation of neutral Belgium and an aggressive war against France as a military necessity in case of war against Russia, with such a two-front war considered inevitable, all preceded the guns of August 1914. It's like there's a, almost like a witch's brew of all these different things that sparked World War One.
Yeah, I think this is an important point because, as I, you know, many people do think that this war is senseless, meaningless, pointless. It's a tragedy. Well, in point of fact, every combatant power, all the great powers that got involved in World War One, thought they had something to gain, with two exceptions. Those two exceptions were Great Britain, which actually came in the war purely because they thought they needed to guarantee Belgian neutrality. That that was a key part of their foreign policy.
Okay, just to clarify this, England came in just because of Belgium, not because of France, but because of Belgium.
The key factor, the British were not, the British had what they called an entente, a sort of friendship with, diplomatic friendship with France, okay, which they'd actually been driven to in part by Germany. but they were not obliged by any treaty to protect France. They were obliged by treaty to defend Belgian neutrality. So at the end of the day, that was the decisive factor in Britain's parliament. Because Britain's parliament debated this, and there were many, of course, who Britain had a very, you know, Britain had the biggest empire in the world. It ruled a quarter of the globe, and yet its army was very small. And they were not prepared in any way for a land war in Europe. So if they could have stayed out of the war, they would gladly have done so, but they could not because they felt they were obliged legally and morally to Belgium. The French were looking to, the French desired a war in a way because they had lost this territory called Alsace-Lorraine.
Oh, yes.
Prussian War.
Oh, man, what a blood-soaked little territory between France and Germany.
Yes. Now, the trick was the French knew that they were not strong enough to wrest that territory back from Germany by force. So they tried to surround Germany with enemies, which they sort of did. But the French, at the when tensions are heating up in 1914, it looks like war might happen, the French actually withdraw troops from their own borders with Germany. So they were not going to fight an aggressive war. They would, that was not on the cards. I think the powers that are to blame are really Russia, which I think is often neglected in this equation, and Germany. Russia is at fault because Austria-Hungary is looking to punish Serbia. They're looking to punish Serbia because Serbian-backed terrorists have killed the heir to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
So in what was Yugoslavia.
Right. So the Austro-Hungarians, they think they're fighting a war on terror, sort of, and they're looking to punish the Serbs. They were looking for a local war. It is Russia, which is the first major power to mobilize for a bigger war. They say, no, you can't do that. If you attack Serbia, it's a war on us. We are defending all Slavic peoples everywhere. So that gets Germany to mobilize for a bigger war. Now, I think the problem with Germany is that Germany, because of this von Schlieffen plan, which envisions an attack on Belgium and into France, even though France is not, you know, a combatant yet, that's where Germany it becomes to blame. Germany launches an aggressive war against Belgium and France to knock France out of any conflict so they can then go and fight the Russians on a one-front war. And this Schlieffen plan, this attack on France, is a telling thing on many levels. One is that, you know, the book is not anti-German, but the German high command was very much imbued with a sense of amorality. In fact, there's a famous quote from the German chancellor, and it was Bethmann Hollweg, and he was appalled when Britain declares war after the Germans invade Belgium. He says, because for a scrap of paper, which is the treaty obligations, Britain is going to declare war on a fellow nation, which he thought was just ridiculous, that, you know, law should be binding. He also said that necessity, and the Germans believe this was a war of necessity, knows no law. Now, if you go a step a little bit farther behind,
explain that again. You're saying
okay,
that
well, necessity
Germans
knows no law. This is very much of a German attitude into the war, which was that anything was permissible if it was necessary. So, for instance, you do an example which reverberated broadly both in Britain but also in the United States is that when the Germans attack Belgium, they make a point of terrorizing civilians, of executing priests, of killing women and children, of tearing down towns, blowing up the ancient city of Louvain and destroying its medieval library. Yeah. Some of these excesses were exaggerated in the press, but it's actually a myth that there was a myth about these things. These things really happened. And the Germans justified them because they wanted to show they wanted to ensure that there was no civilian resistance to the German occupation of Belgium. Now, there are several American links to this, one of which, though, is, I think, crucially important. It involves a man named Vernon Kellogg. Vernon Kellogg was an American biologist based in California who was also a pacifist. He goes over to Belgium as part of the war. America is a neutral power, is providing war relief to Belgian civilians. And in this capacity, he gets to know a lot of the German officers, the high command in Belgium, in Brussels, has dinner with them all the time. And many of them the German high command was highly educated, so he's meeting all these very well-educated generals and other senior officers, many of whom in civilian life had been scientists like himself.
Right.
And he is astonished to find out that they are completely shot through with this social Darwinism,
right,
which justifies brutality and aggression as a sort of proof of the superiority of Germany. And he comes out of this experience utterly appalled and says, look, I am not for war, but I am for this war because this mentality must be stopped. Wow. And I think it is obvious that the Second Reich, which is what the German Empire was called at the time, was the Second Reich, was not as evil as the Third Reich. They did not have the Holocaust of the Jews. But the seeds of much of what was in the Third Reich were already present in the Second Reich.
Are you familiar with a short film called The Biology of the Second Reich, put together by the Discovery Institute?
Yes, I think I have seen that, in fact. Yeah. I think a friend sent that to me in the course of this.
Yeah, yeah. It's the same basic point. We're talking right now with Harry Crocker III, and he's written a book called The Yanks Are Coming, A Military History of the United States in World War I. Continue, sir. I interrupted
you.
Well,
one thing I was going to say was that Vernon Kellogg, actually the biologist I mentioned,
wrote a book. Yeah.
And the introduction to that book was written by Theodore Roosevelt.
Oh, wow.
Because Roosevelt, unlike Woodrow Wilson, thought that America needed to get into the war. Woodrow Wilson did everything he could to keep America out of the war. His first Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, was a near pacifist. His Secretary of the Navy was a near pacifist. His Secretary of War, his first choice Secretary of War would have been a Quaker, who deferred, saying this, as a Quaker, I shouldn't be Secretary of War. But he chose another near pacifist. And he had no interest in the war. He liked to preach to the world, Woodrow Wilson did. But his preaching to the world required him to not be a combatant in this war. It required him to stand above it and say, look, we are here to arbitrate peace without victory. I'm a man too proud to fight, as he said after the sinking of this passenger ship, the Lusitania, by the German submarines. He did everything he could to stay out of this war. Theodore Roosevelt thought at first that there was no American cause to fight, but as German atrocities became better documented, and especially as German submarines, what were called U-boats, were sinking neutral American shipping, he thought this was outrageous. And he pointed out in 1917, when the Germans lifted all restrictions on their submarine sinking American ships, he said, look, the German submarine campaign has killed more Americans than were killed at Lexington, Concord, and Bunker Hill. And yet, you know, when we were fighting the British, we were fighting armed men in battle. These German U-boats are killing men going about their lawful business, are killing women and children passengers. They're committing acts of piracy such as no pirate ever dreamed of. And it's outrageous that we should be hiding behind the skirts of the Royal Navy. So he thought that, A, we should be getting in. B, he thought that if we'd been better prepared, we could have deterred the Germans from conducting this sort of warfare. And then, of course, the final straw that finally even broke Woodrow Wilson's rhetorical back was this thing called the Zimmermann Telegram. And the Zimmermann Telegram was actually part of the whole U-boat campaign, the submarine campaign, because the Germans realized that if we do go after American shipping, it could bring America into the war. So they invited the Mexicans, the Mexican government, that said, look, if there's a war between Germany and America, we will back you in a war if you want to invade the Southwest United States and take it back from Mexico.
Wow.
So that was a conspiracy too far for even Woodrow Wilson. But a lot of people forget, too, that you know, the Germans committed something like 100 acts of sabotage on the American mainland. The German submarine campaign was surprisingly extensive. The Germans were completely contemptuous of Woodrow Wilson and the possibility of American intervention, in part not just because of Wilson being the sort of person he was, but because our army was very small, and the second most powerful general in Germany, a man named Erich Ludendorff, said, I don't give a darn about America. They can't get here. If they do get here, they'll be here too late. They're too puny. The Germans believed that they could cut off Great Britain's lifelines to the sea, and by doing so, they would win the war, because the French were too exhausted at this point, and the British were completely reliant on their imperial trade. And when the Americans did get in the war in April 1917, we sent some admirals to London, and we talked to the British Admiralty. And to the Americans' astonishment, they find out that the Germans have actually calculated this almost correctly. The British Admiralty says, you know, if we keep losing shipping at this rate, we cannot continue the war. We're done for. So America's intervention is both timely and, in the end, decisive.
Wow. All right. Harry Crocker III is our guest. The Yanks Are Coming, A Military History of the United States in World War I. Is there a website dedicated to the book, or people can just get it online or wherever, right?
They can just get it online in the normal channels, at Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or in the stores, of course, out in the shopping malls.
Books a Million, et cetera.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now we're talking about World War I, which really helped shape and cast a long shadow on the world in the beginning of the 20th century, and in some ways you think about all the blood that was shed in the 20th century, and a lot of it gets back to what happened in World War One, in the sense that Russia collapsed after the end of World War One, and then the Bolsheviks and later the Soviets took over. Well, Bolsheviks morphing into the Soviets. Then you had the seeds of World War Two were essentially sown in the treaty, the Versailles Treaty in 1918, the conditions were so difficult for the Germans that they were virtually waiting for somebody like Adolf Hitler. And so it was really, World War One changed the whole world.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is of today's relevance, the map of the modern Middle East comes out of the First World War. I mean, that's where we get Iraq and where Syria and Lebanon and Israel all have their borders. That all comes out from the First World War. That's actually drawn up on a map by Winston Churchill and Lawrence of Arabia. Decide a lot of that.
And Lawrence of Arabia, his campaign, of course, was all part of World War One.
Yes, absolutely. Now, I do think it is it is true that World War One seems like Chapter One of a bigger war, which World War Two is Chapter Two. But Churchill himself said that there was no war easier to prevent than World War Two.
Mm.
And even though the even at the time people worried that the debts and whatnot they were put upon Germany at the Versailles Treaty were excessive. It should also be borne in mind a couple of things. One is that the punishments that were placed on Germany at the Versailles Treaty financially were less than the Germans had placed on the French at the end of the Franco-Prussian War. Moreover, many of the more stringent requirements put on Germany were either lessened over the years or dropped completely. And when Hitler comes to power, he doesn't bother to pay the debt at all. So as Lloyd George, who was the Prime Minister of Britain, said, look, somebody had to pay for the war. Somebody's got to pay for all these bills you've got. Why shouldn't it be the Germans as opposed to the British taxpayer? Now, as it turned out, a lot of the debts that were owed were not just the Germans owed debts, but the British owed debts to the Americans. So the victors were also deeply indebted. But I think also to say that World War II is inevitable, I think is also a mistake in this sense, which is that we don't want to deny what a great victory the Western Allies' victory in the First World War really was. I mean, a lot of people think about the First World War generals as these stupid men who just tried to throw men against artillery shells, were actually the biggest killer in the First World War. But in point of fact, think about this. World War One, the First World War is won in 4 years. It costs about 17 million lives. Mm. Its geopolitical reason is pretty kind of sort of similar to what to World War II's, at least in the European theater, in that should Germany be allowed to militarily subjugate the continent of Europe? They said no in the First World War, said no in the Second World War. In the Second World War, though, the Second World War takes 6 years. It costs more like 60 million lives. Mm-hmm. And if the outcome of the First World War was an imperfect one with the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, as you mentioned, at least at the end of the First World War, the Allies keep the Bolsheviks penned in Russia. At the end of the Second World War, of course, Stalin marches Soviet troops into Eastern mm-hmm. Europe. And I try to make the point in the book that the imperfect outcome of the Second World War does not make that war seem like the bad war. Well, the imperfect outcome of the First World War should likewise not overshadow what was gained and why the war was worth fighting and worth winning.
Okay, how about a brief comment about Patton's role in World War One? You're right. Most of us had no idea he was there.
Yeah, well, here's another little factoid about Patton. How many people know he was an Olympian? Patton was an Olympic athlete. He
in what sport?
It was the pentathlon.
What does that mean?
They called it. It meant that he did some horseback riding, running, sword fighting, and swimming. I might click them all off. It was supposed to. It was an event meant to replicate what an officer would do carrying a message during wartime.
Wow.
That's very fitting. He should be competing.
Yeah.
If I remember rightly, he came in, I'm guessing here, but it was like fifth or seventh or eighth, something like that.
In the Olympics. Tremendous. Tremendous.
Yeah, so Patton was a cavalry officer, but quickly realized that horseback riding into the battlefields of the First World War was not likely to get very far. So he became a tank commander, our first big tank commander, and saw action with tanks in World War One. And my favorite World War One anecdote about Patton is when he and MacArthur are actually standing on the same battlefield, and these artillery shells start heading towards them, and this sort of dirt keeps getting kicking up closer and closer and closer. And it's sort of like this Mexican standoff of who's going to flinch first. And in point of fact, it is Patton who ducks a little bit when the mud comes flying over his head from this artillery shell. And MacArthur very coolly says, Colonel, don't worry, you never hear the one that gets you.
You're never here when they get when it gets you? What?
Yeah, but you'll never hear the shell that's actually going to get you. So if you hear the artillery shell hitting the ground, if you're feeling mud in your face, don't worry, you're alive.
Oh, okay,
so
good.
This is this great scene, seeing these two epic American generals having this sort of standoff on the on a World War One battlefield.
And whose epic role, of course, was to come later, as you pointed out, in World War II. You mentioned tanks. This is the first major war in which they're being used, right, World War One?
Yes. Well, World War One, you've got the war under the sea with the U-boats, submarines. You've got the war in the air with...
First time.
And then, yes, you've got tanks. Tanks are very cumbersome and not terribly effective in the First World War. But Patton was an innovator in that in a big way. Also, though, I mean, we should not forget our are air aces. I mean, Eddie Rickenbacker gets a chapter in the book. He's a great story. Eddie Rickenbacker is the son of Swiss immigrants, has a sort of R gang-like sort of little rascal sort of youth, becomes a race car driver, and then comes to France with General Pershing as a driver and becomes a pilot and becomes our ace of aces, the best ace we had. And flying with him is Quentin Roosevelt, one of Teddy Roosevelt's four sons,
wow,
all of whom see action in the First World War,
wow,
two of whom are very badly wounded.
Mm.
Quentin, the youngest, is actually killed, and all the three surviving brothers, all of them end up serving in World War II. One of them actually landing, the only general to actually land with the initial force on Normandy at D-Day.
Wow.
He actually dies in the Second World War. So, I mean, and there's a whole chapter to it, to Teddy Roosevelt and his children who served in the war, which I think is that, too, is a great, very sad story. But actually, this is maybe interesting, too, that the Teddy Roosevelt, the chapter of Teddy Roosevelt's children, here are people, you know, who have this incredible father who mm-hmm. fights himself in the Spanish-American War, who wanted to go back to rejoin the colors in World War I, but was denied by Woodrow Wilson. But here his children are people who experienced that life in the White House, fight in the First World War, fight in the Second World War, and one of his daughters, says that our lives, the most important point in our lives, has been and will always be the First World War.
Mm.
And you think of this, you know, great American family, and that being the focal point, the climax, in a way, of their lives because of what happened during it. And yet it's a war that is, as we've started this conversation, you know, talking about, that is so apparently completely forgotten by so many Americans.
Mm. Okay, we're almost out of time, but how about a closing up here on the Ottoman Empire, because that's very significant, and that's still with us today. The caliphate was dismantled in the 1920s because of World War I as part of the aftermath, and then out of that grew the Muslim Brotherhood, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes. Now, the Ottoman Empire was always known as the sick, or not always, but it was known at the time as the sick man of Europe, and it allied itself with the Kaiser's Germany and Austria-Hungary. So it was involved in some of the major battles. The Gallipoli campaign is a famous one, where which they made a movie with Mel Gibson. but Lawrence of Arabia actually is the man who helps topple the Ottoman Empire in its reach down to the Arabian Peninsula. And as I said, the Ottoman Empire is sort of carved up, and you get countries formed like Iraq and whatnot. But I don't think we should say, you know, if only the Ottomans were still in charge, because that wouldn't have lasted forever anyways, A. But B, we forget that when these countries were first carved up and the British or the French moved in to govern them, you know, they were at pretty much peace until the Second World War. I mean, there were little outbreaks here and there, as there always are in that part of the world. But Lawrence of Arabia was actually quite content, thinking, you know, actually the Middle East, he has a quote like this, because the Middle East has done quite well out of the war. And one thing, I think we could learn a lot from the British experience in that part of the world and in this period, because, you know, here Iraq was shaped, formed, created by the British. They put a pro-Western, pro-British leader in charge of it. And yet, you know, the British were also involved with Afghanistan. The British never thought to try to do what we talk about when we talk about nation building. They would never have thought of spending $1 trillion and countless lives in governing these provinces. The British Empire was run on the cheap. It was run, I once did a little calculation, it was run on what Best Buy department stores has annual earnings. And with that, they governed a quarter of the globe, and they did it because they governed with a very light hand, A. B, they didn't try to make Arabs or, you know, Afghans anything other than what they are. They mm-hmm. just said, that's fine. And they worked through local alliances. They tried to work through local rulers as much as they could. So they didn't have to occupy lots of places with lots of troops. And they did it on the cheap. So they had the RAF flying occasional patrols. They had, you know, an individual man, individual British officer, and some fellows, of course, who worked with Arabs and these sort of Arab legions to guide where they should bomb if there are bad guys coming. And that's how you, I think, patrol, fence in, put down terrorism in that part of the world.
And I think we're basically out of time, but I think if people want to get more information on that, they look at your other book, which is The Politically Incorrect Guide to the British Empire, as I recall.
Indeed. I have a whole book on that, too. Yeah.
Good. Harry Crocker III, again, the book we've been talking about today, The Yanks Are Coming, A Military History of the United States in World War I. Harry, thanks so much for being with us. All the best.
Great.
Okay.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye now. Thanks.
Bye-bye.